Today's episode contains depictions of violence, so if you have children in the room, please consider listening with headphones. Hi, and welcome again to Don't Know Beach About History, short histories of Long Beach, brought to you by the Long Beach Public Library. I'm Jeff Whalen, local history librarian here at the Billie Jean King Main Library in Long Beach, and today we're going to be talking about the incredible Tiger Girl murder case, the gruesome 1922 Hammer murder that the LA Times called one of the most fiendish crimes in the history of California, and how a 20-year-old Long Beach chorus girl became the prosecution's star witness against her 23-year-old chorus girl friend, who was accused of brutally striking down a romantic rival in a violent haze of rage, jealousy, illegal booze, and poor life choices. And though the case is largely forgotten now, it was the subject of intense attention at the time, with the accused receiving an almost cult-like following in the public, and the case became one of Southern California's very first trials of the century. Joining me again today is Josh Sanchez, Teen Services Librarian here at the library. Welcome, Josh.
Thank you for inviting me back and using my full title.
Now, this episode is a true crime one, Josh. We haven't done a true crime episode on the podcast yet.
I can't wait.
And it's a good one. So it's going to be like a super duper double bonus two-part episode. We've done two-part episodes before in the past, but this one's like a super duper double bonus one.
It's like two Christmases.
It's like your parents are divorced and you get the Christmas with your mom and then you go have Christmas with your dad and his new family. Okay. There's just too much interesting stuff in this story. And, you know, for such an interesting case that was so big at the time, it's amazing that there haven't been any books or movies or really anything about it since. Had you heard of it, Josh?
No, never.
No.
No,
no, you hadn't.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, nobody has. So are you ready for this, though, Josh? Because it's a wild one. It's shocking.
I didn't sign up for that.
Josh, this is not for the faint of heart. It's murder most foul.
Yeah, let me switch to my seated desk. I'm at my standing desk now.
The newspapers of the day said the Tiger Girl murder was one of the worst crimes ever recorded in California. And maybe it is, Josh. Maybe it is. But maybe at its heart, it's a love story, depending on your definition of the word love.
I don't have one.
Buckle up, Josh. This is a crazy story full of craziness. And just when you think it's over, man, it ain't over. And then, just when you think it's over again, then it's pretty much over. Okay. So there are three main women in this story, kind of the main characters, and they are Clara Phillips. She's the Tiger Girl. She's the murderer. She did it. She definitely did it. Or did she? Yes, she absolutely did do it. Or did she? Yes, she did. They call her Tiger Girl or Tiger Woman or Tiger Lady. The newspapers call her all of these things due to the brutality of her crime and also due to her fierce, cat-like sense of self-possession. You'll read sometimes that Clara was called Tiger Girl because a policeman at the crime scene had said that the victim looked as if she had been mauled by a tiger. But I can't find any reference to that until decades after the crime, so I feel that that may be apocryphal.
Okay.
Okay, so that's woman number one, Clara Phillips, Tiger Girl. She's 23, a sometimes chorus girl and model, and married to an oil promoter in Los Angeles. She's the murderer. She did it. That's Clara. Okay. Woman number two. Alberta Meadows, our victim, the mistress, maybe, supposedly. Alberta is 20 and a widow and is believed by Clara to be having an affair with Clara's husband, Armor. And so Clara does something about it. That's woman number two, Alberta Meadows, the victim. And woman number three, Peggy Caffey, the witness. Peggy is also 20 and splits time between LA and Long Beach with her oil worker husband. She, like Clara, is a sometimes chorus girl and aspiring actress/model. And Peggy had met Clara when they were performing in a show together at the Pantages Theater in Hollywood. Peggy and Clara aren't really BFFs, but they spend an intense couple of days together leading up to the murder, including the day of the murder, drinking whiskey, confiding in each other, and shopping. At the trial, Peggy becomes the prosecution's key witness. All right, sound good?
I think I got it all straight.
Those are the main players.
Hopefully.
That's Clara the Tiger Girl, Alberta the victim, Peggy the witness.
Got it.
And let's start with Peggy. She's our Long Beach connection, Josh. And I never want to miss a chance to talk about Long Beach in the 1920s.
Yeah.
My, oh my, Josh, what can you say about Long Beach in the 1920s? Was it the cat's pajamas? Brother, it was the bee's knees. The 1920s are often referred to as the golden age of Long Beach, and why not? At the turn of the last century, Long Beach was consistently one of the fastest growing cities in the nation. By 1922, Long Beach was positively jumping. The massive oil strike in Long Beach and Signal Hill had happened just the year before, in 1921. Money, people, more money, more people. World War I was over. The Spanish flu epidemic was over. And there was fantastic optimism in Long Beach. Construction up, tourism up, jobs up, women wearing fox stoles with the fox's head still on it, up. Now, Long Beach had always had an interesting relationship with alcohol, as perhaps we all do. With the city historically being pretty much dry even before Prohibition, as Long Beach historian Claudine Burnett notes in her excellent book Prohibition Madness about the dark side of 1920s Long Beach, when Prohibition came in 1920, Long Beach locals already had systems in place for acquiring booze in a town that didn't allow it. And as a result, Long Beach had a bit of a reputation in the Southland as a place for folks to score a bottle or two if need be. For one thing, Long Beach was one of the main SoCal harbors for rum runners bringing hooch from Canada and elsewhere. There were countless busts, but the bottles kept coming into Long Beach, and more than a few of those bottles stayed in Long Beach. And did Long Beach have speakeasies? Now you're on the trolley. But it seems they didn't usually call them speakeasies. They more often referred to them as blind pigs for some reason. Like, here's a quote from the Long Beach Chief of Police Ben McClendon in 1921. Numerous times lately, it has been called to my attention that prominent citizens have declared liquor was easy to get in Long Beach. If this be true, the police want to know. If anyone in Long Beach knows the whereabouts of any blind pigs in the city, it is his duty as a loyal citizen to divulge that information to the police.
I bet that worked.
Yeah. So that was kind of the scene in Long Beach when a young married couple, Peggy and Jack Caffey, moved here in the early 1920s. Jack, who went by Jack or the initials MD, was an oil worker for the Wilshire Oil Company, working there in Signal Hill, and Peggy, who was 20, was an aspiring actress who had been working at the Empire Theater in Long Beach, a vaudeville and movie theater at the corner of American Avenue, later named Long Beach Boulevard, and Ocean Boulevard. Did you know that Long Beach Boulevard was once called American Avenue?
I did.
You did. Peggy and Jack had been kind of splitting time off and on between an L.A. apartment and a Long Beach apartment as they figured out what they were doing with their young lives. The place they had at the time in Long Beach, by the way, was at the Hotel Yale at First and Pacific, which was across the street from Lincoln Park and the Long Beach Library, just right across the street from where we are right now, Josh. Mm-hmm. Peggy had gotten some work as a chorus girl in Hollywood, and she was mostly based at their L.A. place, while Jack was mostly based in Long Beach. And she and Jack would see each other whenever. Now, I don't know anything about their marriage. I don't really know anything about anybody's marriage, Josh. That's none of my business what people do. But that said, Peggy wasn't seeing Jack as much as she would have liked. And she had started to wonder what Jack was getting up to in Long Beach on those increasingly frequent days when she wouldn't hear from him. Mm-hmm. So a couple years before this, Peggy had gotten a chorus girl gig at the Pantages Theater in Hollywood in a show called Bob Albright's Broadway Follies. And while performing there, and on the road a bit, they did some shows in San Francisco and even played in Long Beach at a vaudeville theater called Hoyt's on the Pike. She had made friends with a fellow chorus girl, a 23-year-old looker named Clara Phillips, soon to be known to everyone everywhere as the Tiger Girl. Here's how our story begins. On the night of July 12, 1922, 23-year-old Clara Phillips pulled into the driveway of the Los Angeles house where she lived with her 27-year-old husband, Armour Phillips, a supposedly up-and-coming oil promoter. They'd gotten married when she was 14 and he was 17 in Texas. But then a couple years later, they got divorced. And then they got married again. Or did they? They said they did, though there's some question about did they really. But in any case, Clara and Armour moved to L.A. to pursue their happiness. And things had gone pretty well at first in Armour's business dealings, and they had a nice house and nice things, but word was Armour was increasingly over his head financially. And again, I don't know about people's marriages, Josh. That's not within my purview. But it seems they were known among their friends for having one of those dramatic, passionate relationships with lots of intense feelings and big demonstrations of love, but also lots of big dramatic fights and major fits of jealousy. Do you know people like that?
Yes.
So on that summer night in 1922, Clara pulls into the driveway, which was notable enough given the fact that she didn't own a car. But it was perhaps more notable because the car she was driving was owned by 20-year-old Alberta Meadows, the woman that Clara believed to be stepping out with her man, Armour. Clara gets out of the car, and she's covered in blood, by the way. It's all over her clothes, it's in her hair, it's on her shoes, it's everywhere. And Clara walks up to the house, and she opens the door, and she calls out to her husband. And in a calm, happy voice, she says, "Darling, your pretty sweetheart isn't so pretty now." And she said, "Now I'm going to cook you the best supper you ever had." Armour relates all this to the police the next day. He told them, quote, "She came home to me and thought she had done something to be proud of." Okay, but that's the next day. On the night in question, Clara comes in saying, quote, "The one you love is no more," and happily tells Armour the events of the evening, how she got so bloody, why she's driving Alberta's car, why there's the business end of a bloody hammer in the car. And Armour listens and says, "Geez, babe," or whatever the 20s equivalent of "geez, babe" is. And he says, "Right, we got to get you out of town." So he gets Clara to take a bath. She changes clothes. He helps her rinse out the bloody clothes in the bathtub. And he gets into his car, and she gets into the other car, and they caravan out to Pomona. And they abandon the car at the Pomona Greek Theater, which existed back then. And they throw the bloody clothes out the window along the way, and they also throw the bloody hammer part out the window as they drive as well. And they head back to LA, downtown, and check Clara into the swanky Baltimore Hotel under a fake name. And she goes to bed. And Armour spends the night walking around downtown Los Angeles, pacing and walking and smoking, just trying to get his head straight. In the morning, Armour wakes Clara up, and he takes her to the train station, and they buy a ticket. And Armour gives Clara all the money he has on him, and he puts her on a Southern Pacific train to El Paso, Texas. Once Clara's on the train, though, Armour starts doing some more thinking. He's having some doubts about how they've handled it so far. So he goes that morning and meets with his lawyer and tells him what's happened. And the lawyer says, "Geez, Armour," or whatever the 20s equivalent is. And he says, "Dude, you got to go to the cops right now and tell them everything." So Armour does. He goes to the cops and tells them everything. Everything Clara told him the night before and everything they did after that. And the LA cops send a telegram to the Tucson cops. And the Tucson cops go to intercept the train and arrest Clara. They board the train and start yelling her name, but there's no response. So they start going compartment by compartment. And when they open her compartment, Clara acts all offended. And because it's the 20s, says, "Say, what's the idea?" That's literally what the paper quotes her as saying several times to the police. And on a side note, people are really saying, "Say, what's the idea?" It happens like 3 or 4 times that someone says that, either in the trial transcripts or somewhere along the line. They say, "Say, what's the idea?" And I really wanted to include all of them. But this is the only one that makes it. Just heads up.
Oh.
And she also denies she's Clara Phillips. She says that her name is actually Clara McGuire. And she sticks with that story for the next couple days before they can confirm her actual identity. And they put her on a different train, this one heading back to L.A. The press notes that Clara is defiant in her manner and almost aristocratic about it all. The press is all over this big time. They love it. The vibe in the press is good-looking young people and their horrifying and yet very interesting romantic murder. The coverage is breathless and super tabloidy. As the case goes on, each minor angle and step is covered religiously, with a number of newspapers sometimes devoting multiple stories a day, often every day, about it for months. The press immediately casts Clara as this almost awe-inspiring figure of fascination. The stories note her beauty constantly and her poise, her impressive manner, as Clara calmly smiles her way through the arrest and press questioning. There's pictures of her on the front page smiling and laughing, wearing a stylish hat. Everything's great. They print front page pictures of her in a bathing suit on the beach and talk about how all the other girls at her modeling agency were envious of her, quote, due to her beauty and figure. Here's a good example of how the press legitimizes Clara early on. A story about Clara's arrival in LA on the train from Arizona to face charges. This is from a news story in the LA Times. And she did pose for pictures, rewarding the photographers with the broadest smile she had displayed since her arrest. Mrs. Phillips will soon become known as the most unusual and interesting woman ever held in the county jail. It is inevitable. In the face of many extreme discomforts, she has taken everything cheerfully. She is tolerant. She has never yet uttered a single complaint, has never asked for anything, taking all things as they come without a whimper. In the Tucson jail, in her filthy and stifling basement dungeon, she passed 2 nights and days. It reeked with vermin. She slept on a rusty iron cot with no blankets or mattress, only a few newspapers as her bed. She accepted the scant food without a complaint. Patiently, she waited in the midnight hours on the depot lawn for the train that was to bring her back. The night was hot, stifling. Through the night, she slept soundly and arrived in the dining car at 9 a.m., where she ate a hearty meal. Near Yuma, she shed her smartly tailored coat and slipped into a pink silk-flowered kimono. And it goes on like that. That's a news story about a woman accused of murder who was fleeing the state under a fake name and lying to the police about her identity.
Perfect.
And Armour, too. A Wire report about him says, quote, he's rather good looking, with heavy brown hair, blue eyes with a glint in them, and evidences of birth and breeding above the average.
That is a very 1920s thing to say.
Right? The press really gets into the idea of Clara and Armour as this intense couple, with a love so real and passionate that she killed a person to protect it. And even if he turned her in, he's pledging to stand by her no matter what because their love remains unshaken. There's an incredible photo, which we're using for the image for this episode, by the way, on the front page of the LA Times of Clara's and Armour's first big meeting after her arrest. It looks like a promo still for a movie where the romantic leads embrace dramatically. It's amazing.
This seems all really well put on.
That's a photo of them meeting in jail. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah, that seems rehearsed, right?
Like, when you just see that, like, out of the corner, you don't think that that's, like, a picture of that. You think it's, like a posed
yeah,
like movie or something.
Smith's album cover.
Yeah. Okay, so the press and the public, too, immediately connect with this image of Clara as this classy, almost heroic figure, and a rabid and vocal fan base quickly develops. Later on, at the trial, her fans show up in big, rowdy numbers, jamming the courtroom and chanting slogans, saying, Clara is innocent! Fight her and you're fighting God!
I love that.
The newspaper said they screamed this, quote, as husky deputies beat them down the stairs. Okay, but that's later. The police feel they have enough to charge Clara with murder based just on what they know already. But they're about to get more, a lot more, when a second person walks into the police station with a story to tell. And who is it, Josh? It's Clara's old chorus girl friend, Peggy Caffey. And oh boy, does she have a story to tell. Now, like we were saying, Peggy had met Clara a couple years before when they were working in the chorus at the Pantages in Hollywood, but they didn't really see each other again after that until they ran into each other on the street in LA about a week before the murder. And when they reconnect, they start spending a lot of time together. As far as I can tell, they spend much of that time talking and shopping. And by talking and shopping, I mean drinking. And also talking and shopping, sure, but also definitely drinking.
Of course.
Don't they know they got prohibition going on, Josh? So Peggy goes to the cops, but in her first conversations with them, she doesn't mention the drinking. That comes out later. People in this story tend to kind of go out of their way to not mention the drinking. Talking about the murder, fine if we have to, but ixnay on the inking dray. The story Peggy tells the police is mostly in line with the story Armour had told them earlier about what Clara had told him. Except for in her story, it turns out that she, Peggy, was there when the crime went down. I'm now going to recount Peggy's story, and she becomes the prosecution's key witness, and I'm going to kind of combine it with Armour's story and other evidence, and I'm going to put in the stuff that Peggy left out of her original story, because there's so many different retellings with different details that it can kind of get a little overwhelming. So I'm just going to lay out the events as they most likely happened based on everybody's story and what came out later. Okay, so the day before the murder, Tuesday, July 11th, 1922, Clara and Peggy are out shopping together, and they're hanging out, and Clara buys a new skirt and a pair of slippers, and she also buys a hammer. A nice, you know, good hammer with some heft to it, Josh, mm-hmm. A claw hammer. Mm-hmm. This is at the Kress 5 and Dime in downtown LA. Kress was a big chain of stores back in the day. There was a Kress in Long Beach as well.
There was, yeah.
The building is still there, by the way, still with the Kress name, though now it's an apartment building with an organic market on the ground floor.
Yep.
On the corner of 5th and Pine.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that tip, by the way.
You're welcome.
So as Clara and Peggy are hanging out and buying hammers, they're also making phone calls around LA trying to get some booze. And it's a little unclear if they actually get any booze, though they're certainly trying to. Either way, they're talking, and they're spilling the tea, Josh, or whatever the 20s equivalent of that is, and they're commiserating about their husbands, and Peggy tells Clara about her suspicions about her husband Jack in Long Beach while she's in LA. She'd go 5-6 days without hearing from him at times. She said that Jack had trouble getting a stable job, even in the oil fields of Long Beach, and she was also worried that he might fall back into his drug habit. And Clara listens and sympathizes, and then tells Peggy about her husband, Armour, probably messing around with this girl, this Alberta Meadows. Or so the neighbors have told her. Now, Alberta Meadows, the supposed mistress, is 20 and she's newly widowed because her husband was an electrician for the Pacific Electric Line, those famous red cars that used to take people around Southern California that people still like to talk about how great they were.
I'm one of those people.
And her husband, are you one of those people?
I love it. Yeah, I have a poster of the old map in my house.
Do you like to talk about how there were orange groves as far as the eye can see?
Yeah, the city I grew up in was an orange grove.
And would people talk about how this whole area used to be orange groves as far as the eye can see?
Yep.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. Alberta Meadows' husband had been killed by electricity a few months before when he picked up a steel tape measure that was touching a trolley line. So Alberta gets $4,000 from the Pacific Electric Company for his death. And she ends up getting a job as a currency clerk at the First National Bank in downtown LA. She and Clara are familiar with each other through mutual social scenes. They live less than a mile from each other. And I guess they're friendly, but they're not close friends or anything. So Clara's telling Peggy about this girl she's heard is stepping out with her husband, and Clara and Peggy talk some more. And maybe they drink some more, or maybe they don't. And maybe they're getting each other fired up a bit too, because a little later, the two decide to go to Alberta's apartment to ask her some questions. And so they go, and they quietly go up the back way to avoid being seen by the landlady. And they literally tiptoe, apparently, down the hallway. They don't knock on Alberta's door, but they peek in her keyhole and look around and end up deciding she's not home. So they go back to Peggy's apartment and they hang out some more and they both end up crashing out there. In the morning, apparently still in the same frame of mind, they get up and go down to the First National Bank to try to run into Alberta arriving for work, but they miss her. So they say, hey, let's get some booze. And they make a call, but they strike out. So they decide to head to Long Beach, where they're pretty sure they can get some. And Clara and Peggy spend the day in Long Beach, drinking at a speakeasy or at a Blind Pig or at a friend's house or whatever you'd like to call it, rapping about their men problems and also tipping back a few glasses with some guys they know there. And in the afternoon, they leave to head back to LA and they bring a road bottle back with them.
Road bottle?
Yeah.
Like one for the road?
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. Smart.
Well, yeah, because, you know, might as well get it while you can.
Sure.
Long Beach is the place.
I love that endorsement of Long Beach, by the way.
So they head back to L.A. and go immediately to the First National Bank, where Alberta is just getting off work. And they meet her, all friendly-like, and say, oh, what a coincidence running into you. And Clara asks if Alberta might possibly be free to give them a ride to Clara's sister's house up on a remote, lonely road near the L.A. neighborhood of Highland Park. Witnesses say that the three women were all smiling and talking in a friendly manner. And Alberta agrees to give them a lift, and Clara offers her a pull from the bottle, but Alberta declines. And Clara is wearing a cape, by the way. A cape in July, Josh.
Come on.
What do you think?
That's not very sensible.
But you could hide something in there. Hammer-shaped.
It's true.
So off they go, and they're chatting comfortably about this and that as they go, all three sitting in the front seat of Alberta's Model T. Until they get to Montecito Drive. It's a pretty obscure road, kind of in the hills there above Arroyo Seco, where the 110 freeway is now. Clara asks Alberta to please pull over for a moment, and Alberta does. And for the dialogue here, I'm going to use the quotes of the exchange as given by Peggy in her grand jury testimony. I'll narrate, but when people talk, it'll be taken directly from her testimony. Okay. So Alberta pulls over on the side of this remote road, no houses, nobody around. And Clara says, Alberta, by the way, you have lost your husband, haven't you? And Alberta says, yes, he has been dead 7 months, and I sure feel bad about it. And Clara says, Alberta, would you step out of the car, please? I would like to speak to you about a few things. And she turns to Peggy and says, will you pardon us, Peggy? And Clara and Alberta step out. And Clara says, Alberta, now I want to know. My neighbor has told me that you have been going with my husband and that my husband has bought those tires, those big tires on your coupe. To which Alberta says, your husband? I haven't had anything to do with your husband and he has never bought a thing for me. At which point Peggy gets out of the car too. And Clara says to Alberta, he also purchased you a wristwatch. And Alberta says, no, Mrs. Phillips, I have the bill of sale. I bought that myself. And Clara says, he certainly did buy it. And pulling out the hammer from beneath her cape, and Peggy would testify this was the first she'd seen of the hammer since they bought it, Clara brings the hammer down on the head of Alberta Meadows. The blow sends Alberta staggering but doesn't knock her down. She regains her footing somewhat, starts kind of stumble running down the road, while a thoroughly stunned Peggy freaks out too and starts running in the opposite direction up the road. When Peggy turns around to see what's happening, she sees Clara has caught Alberta and is walking her back up to the car. Peggy testifies that they were walking in such a way that she thought that they had made up and were now just talking. So she too walks back to the car. But when she gets closer, she sees that things are still majorly messed up. And Alberta looks at Peggy pleadingly and says, "Lady, save me." And Peggy tries to get in between them, but Clara looks at her and yells, "Damn you, get out of my way." And with that, Clara pulls back the hammer and starts hitting Alberta in earnest. Here's a description in the newspaper. Again and again, the hammer was driven against the young woman's head. And when all life was gone and the brown hair was matted with blood and the head crushed in at several places, the body was left just where it had fallen, less than a yard from the roadside. Now, Peggy throws up on the side of the road while Clara is beating Alberta to death, starts running down the hill. She gets maybe a mile away. No houses, no cars, no intersections, just this remote road. And she hears the car approaching behind her, and it pulls up next to her. It's Clara driving Alberta's car, and she tells Peggy to get in. And not knowing what else to do, Peggy gets in the car. And Clara says, "Remember, if you say anything about this, I'll kill you. You're in it as much as I am." And Clara is just covered in blood on her face and her hair, all over her dress, all over her hands and arms. And as they drive, Clara asks Peggy to wipe the blood off her face. And Peggy takes her handkerchief and starts to gently wipe Alberta's blood from Clara's face. And we're going to have to leave it there for today, Josh.
Oh,
I know. But come back, though, because you won't believe what's going to happen next time. When Clara goes on trial, or what happens when one of her fans busts her out of jail. Oop, did I say that out loud? That was supposed to be a spoiler alert.
Awesome.
All right, well, we'll see you next time.
Later.